Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Up on today's broadcast. Shining the spotlight on the Vatican's humanitarian activity during the wartime pontificate of Pope Pius XII. And our popular Latin lover speaks to us of John Fisher and Thomas More. Thanks so much for joining me once again. As you may recall, a few weeks ago I promised I'd be speaking to you about the figure of Pope Pius XII, Eugenio Pacelli, who was elected as successor of Peter on the 2nd of March 1939 and who died on the 9th of October 1958. A man about whom much ink has been spilt and many comments made. Comments like the one recently made by the Vatican's Secretary of State, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, at the presentation of a new book by the title of Pius XII. Eugenio Pacelli, A Man on the Throne of Peter, by Italian author Andrea Tornielli. Cardinal Bertone on this occasion highlighted how, for many decades, this wartime pope has been at the heart of heated controversy, referring to the accusations that in the years that went from 1939 to 1958, this pontiff had been allegedly silent both about the Holocaust and indeed Hitler. As Cardinal Bertone put it, it is out of place to accuse him of silence.
Un uomo di chiesa che per la sua santità personale risplende come un luminoso testimone.
Adding, the wartime pope had chosen a prudent profile, acting within the limits of the circumstances imposed on him. Light needs to be shed on these circumstances which contributed to blackening the profile surrounding him. By the way, this press conference came on the heels of the Vatican's Congregation for the Causes of the Saints voting in favour of a decree recognising Pius XII's heroic virtues, a major hurdle in a long process towards sainthood that began in 1967. But picking up on Cardinal Bertone's wish to shed more light on the figure of Pius XII, what I'd like to do in a moment is pick up on this story, focusing in particular on the humanitarian activity carried out by the Vatican during those war years. So stay tuned as I step back in time, dipping into our Vatican Radio archives, telling the story in a very personal manner.
Questo voto l'umanità lo deve alle centinaia di migliaia di persone, le quali senza veruna colpa propria, talora solo per ragioni di nazionalità o di stirpe.
Hundreds of thousands of persons, through no fault of their own, sometimes only for reasons of nationality or race, are destined to death or to a gradual extinction.
It was Christmas 1942, and war had been raging for over 3 years. Pius XII had consistently, persistently denounced the horrors of the war and of the Holocaust.
È l'olocausto per un nuovo migliore ordine sociale. Questo voto l'umanità lo deve all'infinita dolente schiera di madri, di vedove e di orfani.
His appeals for peace fell on deaf ears. His appeals for humanitarian relief did not.
The humanitarian work of Pius XII during the tragedy of World War II was extraordinary. Because the human dimensions of the greatest war of history are staggering. Millions and millions of dead. And many more millions were innocent victims of the struggle of war, violence, bombing, deportations, starvation, and all that. And from the very first day, Pius XII knew that from his experience in World War I.
Jesuit historian Father Robert Graham, foremost expert on the Vatican in World War II, helped research and write four volumes of correspondence focusing on the Vatican's humanitarian activity during those tragic years of war.
A non-political activity, which for which now they criticize him for not being political enough. He was a non-political voice, and he was an angel, a relief for millions and millions and millions of people.
That opinion was echoed in an editorial in the New York Times of Christmas 1942.
In these circumstances, no one would expect the Pope to speak as a political leader, or a war leader, or in any other role than in that of a preacher ordained to stand above the battle, tied impartially, as he says, to all people, and willing to collaborate in any new order which will bring a just peace.
We cannot judge him in the context of today. We have to consider what the situation was at that particular time. A few of the sisters told me how frightened they were when the Nazi soldiers or the fascist soldiers would knock on the door and ask them if they had any Jews hidden.
Sister Margherita Marchione spent several years collecting testimonies from some of the thousands of Italians whose lives were saved thanks to Pius XII's strategy of action.
In three of our convents right here in the city of Rome.
This was actually something Pope Pius XII asked the religious to do in those war days, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, he did. He spread the word by word of mouth because it was impossible for him to put in the newspapers what would have happened. The Nazis and the fascists would have gone directly to all the convents and monasteries. He recommended to all the superiors of the convents and monasteries and different parishes to open the doors and to help save the Jewish refugees.
Israel Zolli, chief rabbi of Rome during those years, confirmed this in his autobiography.
The Holy Father sent by hand a letter to the bishops, instructing them to lift the enclosure from the convents and monasteries so that they could become refuges for the Jews. I know of one convent where the sisters slept in the basement, giving up their beds to Jewish refugees. In the face of this charity, the fate of so many of the persecuted is especially tragic.
So impressed was Zolli with Pius XII's zeal in helping the Jewish people that when war was over, he converted to Catholicism, taking the Pope's name, Eugenio. But Rabbi Zolli was not the only one to recognize the Pope's zeal in defending the Jewish people. In January 1945, an extreme fascist, Roberto Farinacci, lamented.
For a few years, Pope Pius XII has fully espoused the Jewish cause to the point of offending the sensibilities of his flock. We never imagined that our pastor, the Vicar of Christ, the head of the Church, could one day be regarded as the most influential defender of the interests of the Jewish people.
Rather than being a silent pope, then...
He was a pope of action, I would say.
He worked in silence.
He did. He had what I would call an underground railroad. And some authors have actually attributed saving the lives of 800,000 Jews and other refugees to Pope Pius XII himself through his representatives, who were the sisters and the priests and the monks in the different areas, and actually in the Vatican itself. Pope Pius XII was able to keep hidden in the Vatican thousands of Jews, not only in the Vatican itself, but in Castel Gandolfo, at his summer estate. For all the years of the war, Pius XII did not go to his summer estate because during that period he had these people hidden. And I have a lovely photograph, Veronica, that shows in a room of Castel Gandolfo, and you know it is Castel Gandolfo because the tapestry has a coat of arms, the papal coat of arms, and it's very clear in this photograph. And there you have about 20 women holding their babies in their arms and feeding them and just living in the apartments of the Holy Father.
Did you ever ever see any of the refugees in Castel Gandolfo, in the papal properties?
Oh, surely. Because very soon, we might say that one of my headquarters was the papal villa. And women with their children were actually right up to the very... to the beautiful crucifix in front of the papal apartments. And there you found, you go and you'd find women bathing their children. And the staircase leading up there, on every step, there was somebody sleeping.
Monsignor Carol Abbing worked closely with Pius XII in organising a relief network for thousands of people on the battlefronts south of Rome.
We were cut off practically from Rome, any kind of regular communication. Pius XII was always very, he looked right through to the substance of something. And he might say, well, why are you telling me this? And he said, what do you plan to do? You see, which was logical. I'd actually not planned to do anything. Just something that I thought was so disastrous. And we were ignorant, you know. We knew nothing, really. And I said, well, I wouldn't even know how to begin. But I know that these people, tens of thousands of people living in the caves, are even just desperately making little caves themselves to get underground because they're terrified. Every day, bombardments and all. At the same time, their worldly goods are all there. Their wine is in the little wine cellars, and if they move, they lose everything, as I was able to see later. So I don't know what, but I said, I think that we should have a better picture of what it is, you see.
So you're talking about thousands of people, are you?
I'm talking about thousands of people, yes. So I said, I'd just like to see what can be done. And he said, God bless you, he said, let me know how I can help you. Without thinking of his own safety in any way, people never seem to value what happened. Were the Nazis happy about him? We say he never denounced them. It's not true. I was present every time the New Year greetings to the diplomatic corps. And it's chilling. I used to shiver listening, and I'd look round and I'd see some of the diplomats with their drawn faces, because these words are they might bring a thunderbolt in the next day.
If the Gestapo had crossed the border between Italy and Vatican City, they would have found refugees hiding everywhere.
This was in November 43. By and by, the house got filled with people hiding from the Nazis for various reasons. Some because they were of Jewish race or origin. Some of their political or military position. Also several young fellows, for the young people who hide in order not to be drafted.
Eva Maria Jung Iglesias was one of those who found asylum inside Vatican City.
So they were sleeping in the museum inside these ancient sarcophages. At least they were safe for a moment. And we made a service day and night round the clock of two who had to watch in case the SS would arrive. Had to be aware of this possibility that the Germans would come in, but fortunately they didn't.
And it was also from the Vatican that prisoners of war could keep in touch with their families.
Calling its correspondent in Bombay. The Vatican Radio is calling its correspondent in Sydney.
The Germans, they thought it was a source of espionage, and they would have nothing to do with it. And there was no messages from messages back from the Vatican Radio to Germany, because it was prohibited to listen to the Vatican Radio. And that was a sore point with Pius XII. Well, as I said, they had a phobia, the Germans did, that this was an intelligence operation. Well, that just shows how little freedom of action the Vatican had in doing this charitable work. But it went ahead just the same. And it was a matter of great pride and consolation for the Pope to be able to demonstrate in this public way that he was concerned for the victims of war.
In England, after the war, the Illustrated London News acclaimed Pius XII as a hero. Winston Churchill's
first cousin,
Sir John Leslie, recalled,
"I remember the Illustrated London News just after the war had a great double sheet coloured photograph of what they called Pius the Great, and it gave a resume of his life underneath, and they looked upon him as a great force for good in the war, which of course he was, and he became a hero, I'd say, the Pope, to England after the war."
And when the war was over, Rome's Jewish community hung the following notice in the city's Museum of Liberation.
A Congress of the Delegates of Italy's Jewish Communities, held in Rome for the first time after the liberation, feels profoundly the duty of directing reverent homage to Your Holiness, and to express the profound sense of gratitude which animates all Jews for the proof of human brotherhood furnished them by the Church during the years of persecution, and when their lives were placed in danger by the Nazi and fascist barbarity. Many times, priests suffered prison and concentration camps, sacrificing their own lives to assist the Jews by every means.
I hope you enjoyed listening to some of the witnesses of people who lived during those years. Let's switch pontificates, going back even further to a time when the founder of our radio station, Pius XI, was Pope. Only to speak of two eminent Englishmen among those whom he canonised, both martyrs. They are Thomas More and John Fisher. Let's do this with our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. I found something that maybe you're interested in.
Ah. John Fisher. Oh, Lord. That's another one.
West Monasterian, which means Westminster, I guess.
Yeah, West Monasteriensis.
The canonization of...
the Blessed Martyrs. Cardinal John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester. And Thomas More, the Chancellor of England.
Okay, in Latin, I'm reading here. Canonizationis Beatorum Martyrum
Cardinalis
Johannes Fisher
Episcopi Rofensis.
How Rofensis becomes Rochester, I don't know.
I don't know how they did it.
Maybe it was
Old Roman name. These are old Roman names.
Maybe Rochester was an old Roman.
Yeah, certainly.
And Thomas More, Tomae.
Tomae More. Cancellarii Angliae.
Why does it start with super dubio? Super doubt?
Yeah, this is, when they're asking a question.
So
and
a
because the doubt is in the next line with these letters here. Whether a commission should be assigned of resuming the case at hand, and for the effect about which we are talking. That's the doubt. Mm-hmm. That it should be undertake once again the case of canonization of these people. And then he goes on, of course, he has to say, yes, of course, but
This was before the founding of our radio station, because this
1930
happened in June 1930.
I see.
The 18th of June 1930.
Very good. Wonderful.
So inter beatos martyris Angliae, qua glorioso, quae gloriosi titulo sanctorum insula appellabatur.
Ah, yeah. Okay, among the blessed martyrs of England, which used to be called the Island of the Saints, with a glorious title.
Was it called the Island of the Saints?
Oh, I don't know. That's what he says. You better look into it. That's not my kind of business. Two illustrious men shine forth like stars.
Stelle,
certainly.
Refulgent. Due lustrus vire tamquam stelle
refulgent. Oh, is that good? Okay, among all the blessed martyrs of England, you see, one in the high degree of ecclesiastical hierarchy, because he was a bishop, and constituted in the Episcopal order, John Cardinal Fisher.
Okay,
the Bishop of the people of Rochester.
Let's move down here. And I suppose Cardinal wrote this, no? Someone called Cardinal Laurenti.
Heaven's sakes.
But would this have been written in Latin by the Cardinal's office, or would there be in those days? Secretary. You would have been out of a job.
I mean, we do these things every day. So, I mean, these are flunkies, you know, secretaries who do this stuff.
You're a flunky. You describe yourself as a flunky.
Well, yeah, I mean, we just blah, 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 blah.
What's a flunky in Latin?
Oh, it's naquam. Naquam. A worthless guy is a flunky. It's naquam.
You know, it's a strange thing, because at Vatican Radio, we don't have a Latin program, but we have an Esperanto program.
Well, you should be ashamed of yourselves. You used to have a Latin program. Some Jesuit, and he, a Slovenian Jesuit, and then he died, and who did you call it? Some other Jesuit said, nah, it's the end of Latin. Well, anyway.
At any rate, if you go down the page, it strikes me how they have a little bit of a biography of Thomas More.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
Who was born in London, Londini Natus,
anno 1480.
1480.
And educated in Oxford.
Oxoni.
Pius Oxonii Educatus. Educated in Oxford.
Why are there two I's on Oxonii?
Because it's what they call the locative. Oxonii in Oxford. Pious from his childhood, and so on and so on. Praebat fidelibus sueba ab Chelsea. He was taking the lead in front of all the faithful of his parish in Chelsea.
A man for all seasons.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
How do you say a man for all seasons?
Omnibus temporibus viraptus. Oh, I can say it better than that. You saw the movie and so on.
Yes.
And his daughters and Henry comes up there.
They speak about Henry VIII.
The daughters go out into the water and say, oh, salve me rex. And they address Henry VIII in Latin. When he came up on his barge up to Chelsea.
How'd you say Henry VIII came up on his barge?
Up
the Thames, rather than to Chelsea.
Chelsea am venit in vicula sua Henricus Rex.
In fact,
in
this text, if you turn that page and you go to the first paragraph here, they speak about Henry VIII. Paulo post Rex Henricus
Octavus.
Octavus is in the Latin numerals, whereas I noticed that the birth of Thomas More, despite being in Latin, was not in Roman numerals.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. That's just the thing.
1480. Anyway, my Latin is, as you know, very limited, but I can see that his wife, Caterina, was irritas et sacrilegia.
No, be careful. No. Henry VIII, who, while his legitimate wife, Catherine, was still living, Tentaverat had tried invalid and sacrilegious marriage with Anna Bolena. Mm. You see the whole story there. When he had not been able to obtain the approval of his crime, nor of a divorce, nor of new matrimony. So when and swan, de facit, this is in line 5, he fell away from the Catholic religion and from obedience toward the Roman pontiff.
A religione cattolica et ab obedientia
erga Romanum pontificem de facit.
Et rebellionis vexillum
erexit. And he set up a flag of rebellion.
A flag.
Well, vexillum, a standard. Oh, it's glorious.
Sub.
Well, we write the same thing today.
Sub quo subditos subditos.
Subditos suos cum nefando et credeli sue religione potus abusu militare coagit. Under which flag he forced subditos suos, his, what do you say, his subjects, to fight with a unspeakable nefando, an unspeakable and cruel abuse of his royal power. Ooh, they're glorious.
They seem to dedicate more time to Thomas More than John
Fisher. Although, yeah, actually, Fisher was the most educated man around. Everyone knows that.
There's lots here in italics.
Well, these are all quotes.
Mm.
Well, that's very good and beautiful. Ooh, I have to save these things. I mean, I just kind of never thought of doing this. And that's why he says this doubt here at the end here.
Where?
Whether the commission should be revised. And he says, affirmative. Where is it? Affirmative.
If affirmative seo signanda.
Namely that a commission should be designated of the resumption of the case if it will have pleased His Holiness.
Well, why is that interesting?
I mean, so that was the end of the doubt. Should we reopen the case of canonization for these two guys? And of course, he says, yes, His Holiness considered this a good thing, and so on and so on.
Who was Pope Pius
the 11th?
Warm thanks, as always, to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, and he's currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State as the Pope's own Latinist. He'll be back again at this same time next week. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening, and bye for now. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.